is 16 valuable heir. Imam Jafar Sadiq, peace upon him, who was also born on the blessed 17th of the month of Rabiul Awwal and revived in society the pure and pristine teachings of his ancestor the Prophet, despite a gap of 136 years separating their respective birthdays. Stay with us for an exclusive feature in this regard. O you who have faith, be wary of Allah and be with the Sadiqeen. This is what God Almighty tells us in Ayah 119 of Surah Maryam of the Noble Quran. The commandment of God is obvious. The believers are asked to follow the Sadiqeen, that is, the most truthful persons. In other words, anyone with even an iota of untruth cannot be among the divinely decreed leaders of the Ummah, whether elected, selected, nominated, designated, or appointed. Today, on the 17th of Rabiul Awwal, we are celebrating the birth anniversary of the Sadiqeen, which is the plural of Sadiq, or the truthful. To be more precise, it is the birthday of two of the most truthful ever persons. Both of them are known in history as Sadiq. Whenever the epithet Sadiq is mentioned, it is either the Prophet of Islam or the reviver of his Sunan Sirah, that is, behavior and practice, his 16th infallible successor Imam Jafar Sadiq, peace upon him. As a matter of fact, Sadiq has become the exclusively epithet of the 6th Imam, who flourished in a crucial period of history, when the Ummah was exposed to the influx of a variety of philosophical and pseudo-religious ideas from the various nations that were coming into the fold of Islam. In addition, the tyrannical regimes had forbidden the collection of authentic hadith and narrations of the Prophet, as well as the proper interpretation of the ayahs of the Noble Quran. As a result, the people were bewildered. Thus, to stop the confusion, Imam Jafar Sadiq, peace upon him, embarked upon rectifying beliefs and correcting the Islamic ideology. The struggle for power between the tottering Umayyad regime and the insurgent Abbasids provided the 6th Imam with the opportunity to take two towering heights, the Academy of Medina, whose foundation had been laid by his grandfather, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace upon him, after the tragedy of Karbala, and which had been developed by his father, Imam Muhammad Baqir, peace upon him. So thoroughly did the 6th Imam revolutionize this academy that at its peak, 4,000 scholars from various parts of the Islamic world spread over West and Central Asia, North Africa, and Southwest Europe sat at the feet of their heir of the Prophet to learn various disciplines, including jurisprudence, theology, rhetoric, ethics, hadith, exegesis of the Noble Quran, accounts of the past prophets and natural sciences such as physics, chemistry, medicine, astronomy, math, botany, etc. Among its distinguished products was the master of rhetoric, Hisham ibn Hakam, the theologian, Aban ibn Thaqlab, the jurist Abu Hanifa, and last but not the least, the father of chemistry, Jaber ibn Hayyan, known as Jaber to medieval Europe. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, shouldered a graver responsibility. First, after the overthrow of the Umayyads, there was the offer of caliphate by Abu Salameh al-Khalal, one of the victorious generals of the uprising, and the imam whose authority was God-given, burned the sealed envelope in the flame of a lamp in order to show the world people and to posterity that the caliphate or successorship to the Prophet is not a position bestowed by fallible persons, but is a divine trust. Alas, when the tyrant Mansur Davanighi assumed power as the second self-styled caliph of the usurper Abbasid regime, he resorted to a policy of threats, pressures, and imprisonment against the Imam of the Truthful, so as to close this famous academy. Nonetheless, Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, during his 34-year imamat, continued the enlightening task of the Prophet to revive in society the genuine teachings of Islam. This naturally brought him into confrontation with persons of devious tendencies, such as the self-assumed Sufis and extremists known as the Qulats, as well as with the pseudo-jurisprudents of his time, who were, for brief period, his students, to use modern terminology, these were actually school dropouts whose names are not worth mentioning here. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, as the most truthful person of his age, deplored the double standards of the Sufis, since most of these self-styled ascetics or mystics either did not practice whatever they preached or twisted matters beyond proportion to lead naive and simple-minded people down the self-destructive path of shunning the blessings and bounties of God. The Imam recommended a spiritual purification, paying attention to spirituality and enjoying the blessings of nature and its manifestations as permitted by the Holy Quran and the practical precedents set by the Prophet. He used to debate with the leaders of Sufism, such as Sufyan Thawri, to convince them that their religious practice was not rational, and on no account God wants his creatures to avoid blessings of food, clothes, and other lawful and permissible pleasures. At the same time, the sixth Imam had to confront the gulat or extremist, who, although claiming to be followers of the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt, had distorted their beliefs and were misleading people by attributing things and characteristics to the infallible Imams that are exclusively for God Almighty. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, openly cursed such persons, saying, "We are servants of God, who created us and made us superior to the others of His creation. Certainly, we shall die and shall stand before Allah for reckoning. He who is a friend of the extremist is our enemy, and he who is their enemy is our friend. The extremists are infidels and polytheists. Curse be upon them." He also said, "Allah's curse be upon those who claim divinity and godhood for Imam Ali. By Allah, Imam Ali was an obedient servant of Allah. Curse upon those who have slandered us. Some people say things about us that we do not say ourselves. We declare that we have no connection with them." The famous Iranian Islamic scholar Sheikh Saduq, who flourished over 1,000 years ago, quotes Zarara ibn Ayun, a reliable companion of the fifth and sixth infallible Imams, as saying, "I told Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, that one of the persons known to him believes in tafwis, That is delegation of divine authority. The Imam said, What is meant by tafwiz? I replied, The man says that Allah created Muhammad and Ali peace upon them and then delegated to them his authority over the affairs of people. So they are the creators and providers of food. They are the animators who give life and they are the killers who cause death. Imam Sadiq peace upon him replied, The enemy of Allah lies. When you go back to him, read him this ayah of the Noble Quran, ayah 16 of Surah Rad. Have they set up for Allah partners who have created like creation so that the creation seemed confusable to them? Say, Allah is the creator of all things and he is the one, the all paramount. It is also worth noting that Imam Sadiq peace upon him had given warnings against indulging in qiyas, that is guesswork of analogy in jurisprudential matters, to his elderly student from Kabul, Noman ibn Sabit ibn Zuta, known as Abu Hanifa, the son of an Iranian convert from Zoroastrianism, who later founded the Hanafi school of jurisprudence. Abu Hanifa is on record as saying, If not for the 2 years I had studied under Imam Sadiq, I would have perished. The sixth Imam shouldered grave responsibility in safeguarding the genuine teachings of his ancestor, the Prophet, in view of the treason of the Abbasid Caliph Mansur in labeling the Shi'ites or devoted followers of the Ahlul Bayt as Rafidun, which means rejectors of the caliphate, and coining a new term, Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah, for those who had no idea of what the real Sunnah and Sirah, or practice and behavior of the Prophet was. No such sect had ever existed before in Islamic history. In the face of such intricate plots, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, as the truthful successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, saved Muslims from confusion. No wonder the code of jurisprudence that he bequeathed to the seekers of truth, and which is known as Fiqhul Ja'fari, is actually the Shari'atul Muhammadi in its most pristine and purest reforms that enables the believers from falling prey to the so-called schools of jurisprudence and sects based on hearsay and guesswork.
The bitter apple of Satan.
Daughters is growing up and they will become a woman. So this is another part of another generation of the society. So.
Thank you. They're the fashion industry's fountain of youth, the legions of young models stomping down the catwalk. But this week, top fashion designer Marc Jacobs is under fire for using models that are too young, according to the Council of Fashion Designers of America, who urge designers to use models that are at least 16. These two are only 14.
Is this 10-year-old model too provocative in her pictures? And in the pictures, you can see her wearing makeup, heels. She looks like a little adult.
Oh, hell no. Hell no. Now, look at these come-hither looks and wrestling off the Harris, right? Guilty. I don't mean her. I mean the people that are taking these pictures. I mean the parents. And what's wrong with the fashion industry? Seriously, I'm asking you, what's wrong with you?
Women are often caught between the tradition and modernity.
Women have not understood that this was a bait.
If we go back to the years when the motion picture film was created by a human and see that era's reflection of society on pictures, we will find women's clothes very different. In 1895, the first film in human history. Let's go back to the past again, about 300 years ago. In 1600s BC, the fashionable clothes were mostly worn by women of cultural society and rich women. Full dresses with some layers and very beautiful. Although ordinary people's clothes were simple, but they were without nudity. We cannot see much difference in clothes until 100 years later. Similarly, beautiful clothes, either luxurious or simple. In 1800s, hats became common and fashionable. In this century, Victorian and Edwardian hats were presented to people, and this clothing style was same until early 1900s. In second decade of 20th century, about 1920s, simultaneously with fast and vast spread of cinema, a film named Flapper was shown, which was completely different from those days' customs and brought unusual clothing style among women. Flapperism wave began with unusual symbols like wearing men's clothes, drinking alcohol, and smoking cigarettes explicitly, free sexual relationship even with people of the same gender, heavy makeup, and short hairstyles. After many years, the traditions were broken, clothes became tighter, and as a result, women behavior changed. What was accepted by women and society for 500 years faded in less than 30 years in a way that it didn't accept any limitation for showing women's body. Since this decade, by cinema help, fashion has become an industry and a widespread social custom, and for the first time, it was presented like today's form.
Hi, my name is Cameron Russell, and for the last little while, I've been a model, actually for 10 years. And I feel like there's an uncomfortable tension in the room right now, because I should not have worn this dress. So, luckily, I brought an outfit change. Image is powerful, and I am on this stage because I am a model. I'm on this stage because I am a pretty white woman, and I'm going to answer the questions that people always ask me, but with an honest twist. For the past few centuries, we have defined beauty not just as health and youth and symmetry that we're biologically programmed to admire, but also as tall, slender figures and femininity and white skin. When I was researching this talk, I found out that of the 13-year-old girls in the United States, 53% don't like their bodies. And that number goes to 78% by the time that they're 17. So the last question people ask me is, you know, what is it like to be a model? And I think the answer that they're looking for is, if you are a little bit skinnier and you have shinier hair, you will be so happy and fabulous. But they're only one half of the story, because the thing that we never say on camera, that I have never said on camera, is I am insecure. And I'm insecure because I have to think about what I look like every day. If there's a takeaway to this talk, I hope it's that we all feel more comfortable acknowledging the power of image in our perceived successes and our perceived failures.
And by help of Pictures Magic, all people's dreams are to be similar to her, and getting close to this dream gives dieting industries $40 billion every year. As a result, according to America's National Eating Disorders Association, 80% of all 10-year-olds are afraid of being fat, and 42% of all first through third grade girls want to be thinner. The toy shows girls' future appearance instead of being today's playing doll. Ironically, it is free and light in clothing.
I ask any woman, and I say, if you wear very little light clothes, will you feel strong to do this interview? You want? And she says, no. I mean, it is nature. It's not only show off, but you want to, when you want to be strong, you cannot do this naked. You cannot see seriously. Even the most modern people, you cannot see seriously a woman with light clothes into asking a high-skilled job. You have seen all the executives, the high executives, they wear suits, right?
Right.
They wear suits. That means that if they want to be serious, they have to be dressed.
And yet Jennifer Lawrence tells Elle magazine, in Hollywood, I'm obese. I'm considered a fat actress. But just take a look at the 22-year-old Oscar-nominated actress on the cover of the December issue of Elle. Is this the new definition of fat? She says, I eat like a caveman. I'll be the only actress who doesn't have anorexia rumors.
Isabel Caro is as shocking a poster girl as you will ever see. Last month, the anorexic woman who weighs less than 70 pounds appeared on billboards in Milan, the fashion center of Italy. Looking at her made us wonder if she would actually survive. CBS News correspondent Sheila McVicker went to Paris to learn more about her.
It was part of an Italian attempt to raise awareness of the disease in the fashion industry. Isabel Caro was the model.
When did you realize that this disease, this illness, could kill you?
It was when I went into a coma about a year and a half ago, and really up to then I didn't realize. I saw death coming for me. I saw what all those people describe when they survive an accident, when they really come close to dying. At that stage, I freaked out. I was so afraid that I took hold of myself, and I said, I have to do something, because I won't have a second chance. I really wanted to live.
How difficult was it to literally begin to eat again?
My stomach rejected everything, so it was very, very hard. I had to get used to eating again, little bites and lots of liquids.
A French model who campaigned against anorexia has died at the age of 28. Isabel Caro posed nude for an awareness campaign while suffering from the disease. It's thought she died last month, but her family asked for her death to be kept private.
Although this model's death was kept secret from medias, ANAD, Anorexia Nervosa and Associated Disorders, reports that the illness is the main cause of death among 14 to 24-year-old American females. 12 times higher than other causes. Are these really beauty criteria? It is wondering what has happened that even a simple head covering is just intolerable to this society, a society that once spoke about Jesus Christ's teachings.
the hijab, I think, is the whole challenge about, even though that Greece is a Christian Orthodox country. And my grandmother was wearing a hijab, a headscarf, like you Iranians wear with the knot in the front. It was a common image, but it was like a symbol of an older age, let's say, the older years. But even the Orthodox Christian should wear, while they go to the church, should wear the headscarf.
Have they forgotten their lost generation? No. They even remember St. Mary's pictures and paintings so clearly that Italy's former Minister of the Interior, Roberto Maroni, says that if the Virgin Mary appears wearing a veil on all her pictures, how can you ask me to sign on a hijab ban law? What has really happened to women of our age?
When you see women who have no ideology, no political position, no religion, they're in the flow of the mainstream, of the trend to go successful and more money, only money, change my car every 2 years, change my phone every 6 months. All this is a trick.
As they try to change our tradition, our faith, make the young girls try to be as American stars, have the same clothes, the same ideas, everything.
Of course, many children have more bitter fate. During three past decades, abortion rate has increased. In Canada, with a population of 33 million people, abortion rate is more than 100,000 a year, 274 abortions a day. Every 22 seconds, an infant put in death hands by its parents before seeing sunshine. Approximately one out of three women abort once in her life before age of 45, that 58% of them are in their 20s and also teens. Mostly 18 to 19 are accounted for fewer than 2 in 10 of all abortion. According to Institute for American Values report, 40% of young boys and girls agreed with white marriage rather than legal marriage to be sure more. Obviously, this thought is a result of phenomenon of common law marriage instead of legal marriage. This is not just statistics, but is a lifestyle, and family sounds to be probably at the end of daily list of this lifestyle.
Dictators wanted the women to stay in a low level, in any way, or very modern, uneducated.
It is surprising that the governments that are supporters of women's rights have no change with dictators who have this kind of thought. The fact is that their goals are the same. Both of these two attitudes towards women have appropriately come together to take her thought and humanistic values. When women lose the essence of their existence and humanity and just rely on their sexuality, the family and then society will lose its essence and gentility. and what object can be more impressive than clothing? Joel Kotkin, an author and social researcher, believes that by 1885, Jews could control 90% of fur industry and the whole of clothing industry in America. This industry became the third big industry of the U.S. The Jews' most power in America's clothing industry is in 1920s at the same time of their dominance over cinema in the country and production of flapper film and fashion. Also, today different brands such as Saint Laurent belonging to Yves Laurent, Guess belonging to Marciano Brothers, Jordache belonging to Nikish Brothers, Polo belonging to Ralph Lauren, Pierre Cardin belonging to Cardin, Coco Chanel of Wertheimer Brothers, and thousands of other familiar brands are in our lives. Their empire has continued and attracted people's minds and thoughts by their names. These brands are extremely interested in sexual show of women and immature teens' bodies in their advertisements. But fashion industry cannot do this big destruction alone. Bob Pittman, one of popular MTV channel managers, says that at MTV, we don't just shoot for the 14-year-olds. We own them. MTV and Nickelodeon are belonging to famous Jew Samuel Redstone. Nickelodeon's deputy, Bruce Friend, also says that in the last 10 years, we've seen a rapid development of upper-age children. The 12 to 14-year-olds of yesterday are 10 to 12s of today.
The woman is the one who keeps the link of the family. So they target the woman, so they target their generations to come. So after they target the woman, they start opening up in the society, and you go the whole society. So a woman can affect the whole society.
We see that they have a particular mechanism which they employ to gain control. And when I'm talking about it, it's very interesting to see that it's not just the Muslim countries that are facing this arrogance. It is all the countries in the third world are facing this arrogance.
People get the fast food, the fast messages. This is what they created. We don't read books anymore, and the history has 50 years now distorted. It was something very, very strange, but they brought something like fashion. But it was a plan. It was not fashion. Fashion is something you cannot define as you go naked, so you're in fashion. It was a plan to destroy the role of the family. This is a big mistake because women have not understood that this was a bait, and they catch the bait, and now they are into this.
As if women of modern age have been attracted to this sweet trickery again and grabbed the bitter apple of Satan among their fingers.
A woman, not only a Muslim woman, but every woman in the world, can have many roles. She can be a worker, a mother, she can be a wife, she can be a friend. I mean, there are so different roles that she has to attend. A Muslim woman has also one more, is to show Islam, to live Islam.
Yes, it's true that most of the intellectual activities that have happened outside the locus of our Muslim world have strengthened a very unipolar world of what we call as USA, or what we call as the European Empire. And these movements have come together with Zionism to you know, to work at destroying something that they fear a lot, which is Islam, which is the actual subscription to those values that they just do lip service to.
You have to be very strong. And if the woman gets strong, she's dangerous to the system.
How is she dangerous to the system?
Free people, free spirits are dangerous to the system. The system wants people who are obedient, people who obey. You have to fight with education also. The Muslim woman, to tell you, simply work actively. Not sit down and say, oh, you're so good, I'm so good. No, 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 we have to finish with that. We have to work and study and show Islam in action. This is it, simple as that.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
The U.S. has the largest external debt in the world, and its fiscal woes are getting worse. According to a U.S. Treasury Department report, the U.S. gross national debt has surpassed $31 trillion, edging closer to the statutory ceiling of roughly $31.4 trillion put in place by Congress, limiting the government's ability to borrow. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. According to Global Times, the current level of inflation in the U.S. should not be underestimated. Coupled with high oil prices, the energy disputes between the U.S., Europe, and Russia, as well as the Russia-Ukraine crisis and other complex international situations, the challenge of a $31 trillion national debt should be considered in the context of the risky crises currently facing Washington. If the persistent upward trend cannot be resolved, the attractiveness of the U.S. as a global pool of capital and talent will be further eroded, hitting its strength in all aspects. However, it's important to note the reality that the U.S. is accustomed to adopting various policies to deflect conflicts, leaving ordinary Americans and other countries to bear the ultimate cost. The U.S. is not playing the role of a stabilizer in the global economy that a major power should do. Instead, it has repeatedly held others accountable for the consequences when it makes mistakes. As the birthplace of several post-World War's global economic crises, the U.S. could once again become a chaos maker at the expense of economic development around the world, given that the debt, as well as its economic and monetary policies, will all raise the possibility of another global financial crisis in the future. Also, New York Times wrote, America's gross national debt exceeded $31 trillion for the first time, a grim financial milestone that arrived just as the nation's long-term fiscal picture has darkened amid rising interest rates. The breach of the threshold, which was revealed in a Treasury Department report, comes at an inopportune moment, as historically low interest rates are being replaced with higher borrowing costs as the Federal Reserve tries to combat rapid inflation. While record levels of government borrowing to fight the pandemic and finance tax cuts were once seen by some policymakers as affordable, those higher rates are making America's debts more costly over time. New York Times added the $31 trillion threshold also poses a political problem for Biden, who has pledged to put the United States on a more sustainable fiscal path and reduce federal budget deficits by $1 trillion over a decade. Deficits occur when the government spends more money than it takes in the thorough tax revenue. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget estimates that Biden's policies have added nearly $5 trillion to deficits since he took office. That projection includes Biden's signature $1.9 trillion economic stimulus bill, a variety of new congressionally approved spending initiatives, and a student loan debt forgiveness plan that is expected to cost taxpayers nearly $400 billion over 30 years. White House budget officials estimated in August that the deficit would be just over $1 trillion for the 2022 fiscal year, which was nearly $400 billion less than they had originally forecast. Biden says those numbers are the product of his policies to stoke economic growth, like the American Rescue Plan. Those figures obscure the effects of the rescue plan, which was financed entirely with borrowed money. Much of the deficit reduction Biden is doing reflects the fact that both he and former President Trump signed laws that borrowed heavily in order to mitigate the damage of the pandemic recession. The deficit has fallen in large part because policymakers did not pass another large round of pandemic aid this year.
Hidden Files.
Being punished for the original sin, and that is beating white supremacy colonialism. That is how some experts describe what has happened and continues to happen to a small but significant nation in the Caribbean, Haiti. Slavery in Haiti began after the arrival of Christopher Columbus on the island in 1492 with European colonists that followed from Portugal, Spain, and France. In the late 18th century and early 19th century, in Saint-Domingue, as Haiti was once called, the French had enslaved 500,000 Africans there. Well, the slaves would harvest coffee, sugar cane, and work the cotton fields and serve the Europeans in whatever ways the colonialists deemed necessary. This island became France's most lucrative possession. Ultimately, the slaves who were treated terribly started revolting against the French. Now, this movement ultimately led to their victory over the imperialist colonialists, and Haiti became the only country in the world where former slaves succeeded in overthrowing their enslavers and establishing their own country. These Africans were able to beat one of the best militaries at the time that was led by Napoleon. He sent 50,000 French troops to the island, but ultimately France and their European and American supporters lost. This is the original sin that Africans were successful in beating European colonizers, and some analysts say the American European Front has never forgiven Haiti for winning and for being black. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Haiti set an example when it declared its independence in 1804. It became the first country in the world to permanently outlaw slavery and ban imperial rule. During a time when slavery was the norm in many countries, Haiti was the symbol of freedom. Haiti broke the common rule of the day that liberty and equality were for white men only. Haiti said that no human beings should ever be enslaved. It sounds very enlightening, but that is not how the French, the Americans, and others saw it. Leaders wanted to do whatever they could in order for Haiti not to succeed. And those who revolted in Haiti wanted to do whatever they could in order for the revolution to succeed.
U.S. President Thomas Jefferson was worried that the revolution in Haiti could ignite a slave revolt in the United States. And he would do his best not to help Haiti's southern slaveholders, who were very fearful that this could spread and encourage U.S. politicians to overthrow the new country. Napoleon Bonaparte, French military leader at the time, wrote, "My decision to destroy the authority of the blacks in Saint-Domingue is not so much based on considerations of commerce and money as on the need to block forever the forward march of blacks in the world." After Haiti had routed the French and its allies, the first leader of Haiti, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, said about the victory, "These impeccable enemies of the rights of man have been punished for their crimes. Yes, we have paid these true cannibals back, crime for crime, war for war, outrage for outrage. I have saved my country. I have avenged America."
Well, when listening to the story of Haiti, it sounds like a part of history that took place a long time ago in the past. But the reality is that as we bring you this program today, the Haitian people are on the streets and have been for months. The people are demanding an end to foreign intervention and the theft of their wealth. They want the United Nations not to interfere, and they want these Western and so-called international entities to stop impoverishing Haiti and to stop trying to enslave this nation once again. Well, to help me look at this further, I'd like to turn to our guest, Dr. Jemima Pierre.
Dr. Jemima Pierre is a professor of African American Studies and Anthropology. Currently, she teaches at the University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA. She is the coordinator of the Haiti Americas team, Black Alliance for Peace, and editor and contributor for the Black Agenda Report.
Well, Dr. Pierre, thanks so much for being with us here at Hidden Files. You know, whenever we hear anything about Haiti, it is always negative and the country's demonized. In your perspective, why is that the case?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a great quote by the African-American abolitionist, Frederick Douglass, who says that Haiti has never been forgiven for winning the revolution against slavery and colonialism. And so we have to start there. We have to start thinking about it's 200 and some years of constant demonization, constant move to suppress Haitian self-determination. And so from the very beginning, so people should know that, for example, you know, Haiti became independent in 1804. The U.S. and the West did not really recognize Haitian independence until 1865. It's been hard going ever since then, trying to maintain sovereignty and independence. And the West, I think, really has this really deep, deep, deep hatred for that history because it did upend the entire system of slavery and colonization in the New World.
Well, I mean, what would you say to some people that, you know, that happened over 200 years ago? Why would they still try to punish Haiti today?
Well, it is interesting, right, to say that for a country that is so small, and for a country that seems insignificant, the U.S. really spends a lot of time and money trying to control it. And so we have to think about, for example, the fact that even after independence, what you had was constant affronts by the French, by the British, but by the U.S. So the U.S. occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934, which is one of the longest occupations in the region, very brutal. In fact, the U.S. Practiced its first aerial bombing campaigns in Haiti during that occupation. The U.S. has the fourth largest embassy in Haiti. So you're saying, well, if Haiti's so inconsequential, why does it have the fourth largest embassy? Why in 2003 did France, U.S., and Canada meet in Ottawa? Your listeners can look up the Ottawa Initiative. Met in Ottawa, basically coming up with a plan to remove the democratically elected president of Haiti, which plan succeeded in February 2004, the year of the 200th anniversary of the Haitian independence. And so there's a lot of history that demonstrates that there's this really deep, deep set of feelings among the Europeans for Haiti. And the way that Haiti is demonized and talked about in the news, the way that things are sensationalized. And so, you know, we in the U.S., where I am currently living, we have mass shootings every day. You know, the schools are in lockdown. This is a very violent country, but it doesn't get represented in the same way that Haiti does if we have a set of protesters. So there's a built-up history of representations of Haiti that allow the world to actually believe that these black people are savages that cannot run themselves. And, you know, the one quote that I wanted to show is, you know, Napoleon, whose army, which at the time was the most powerful army in the day, was defeated by the Haitians. And he wrote, and I have this quote, "My decision to destroy the authority of the blacks in Saint-Domingue," which is what Haiti was called, "is not so much based on considerations of commerce and money as on the need to block forever forward the march of the blacks of the world in the world." And so if you start with that quote, what does that tell you about the feelings towards Haiti? And I think if you see that, and then you've seen all the WikiLeaks files, which were released, and you see the machinations behind U.S. policy in Haiti, then everything comes clear to us. In the Security Council meetings, everyone was saying we need an intervention because there's gang violence. And so then you had the representatives from Albania, of all places, which is like at the edge of Europe and going through its own problems. It's going to have its own security, energy crisis in a couple of months. And then you have Ireland, which barely independent, and you have Kenya. And all these people are calling for intervention because they're saying we need to deal with gang violence. What's interesting is that what doesn't come up, especially for the Latin American countries, is that Haiti is under occupation, right? And that's what I want the world to know. In 2004, when the U.S.-led coup d'etat that removed the president, put him on a plane, the U.S. Marines landed in his house, put him on a plane and flew him to Africa into exile, of all places. And then the U.S. sent the military. U.S., Canada, and France had military folks already on the ground within hours of this removal. And then they were able to get the UN to cover up this by sending in a Chapter 7 deployment of UN peacekeeping. And what you have then is you have this brutal force that was there, you know, with hundreds of thousands of soldiers, a whole apparatus. The way they were able to hide this occupation, because they were able to get a multiracial, multinational force, UN forces, to say that they're stabilizing Haiti. Haiti was not at war. So a Chapter 7 deployment means that they could use force. And the UN, which we call the occupation forces, killed thousands of people. They brought cholera into the country that killed 30,000 people because they dumped feces, you know, fecal matter in Haiti, the main water source in central Haiti. It sickened a million people, killed more than 30,000 people. The UN, it took them 6 years to at least acknowledge that it was their fault. And so you have that. But under this occupation, you had the construction of what they call the core group. And this core group was founded In 2004, right when the UN Security Council resolution said that the force was coming. And the core group, the membership has fluctuated, but it has members from Brazil, Canada, France, Germany, Spain, the U.S., the European Union, the Organization of American States. And they basically coordinate the various branches of the United Nations occupation of Haiti. The core group still runs Haiti.
Wow, it's really something unbelievable. I mean, if we look back at 2003 that you just talked about, with the election of the Haitian president, President Aristide, and he demanded France, after he was elected, to repay Haiti $21 billion in reparations. Now, he was removed in a Western-backed coup the next year, as you had just talked about. Do you think that there is a direct correlation between the Haitian president demanding reparation and him basically being overthrown?
Oh, definitely. You know, he said that, and I think it really riled up the French, the Canadians, and the Americans, and the French in particular. And the French have a really terrible colonial role. I mean, look what they did in Libya and Algeria, and all over West Africa till this day, right? They're stealing all their resources and so on. But that was really, you know, he made that speech the year before in 2003. And by the end of 2003, you have France, Canada, and the U.S. meeting in Ottawa coming up with a plan. And one of the first things they did were when they removed him, and I actually have an article that is called The Archive of Occupation, which lays out day by day how this coup d'etat happened from from all of early 2004. And what you see is as soon as they find this guy that they bring in and they make him, interim prime minister. So they remove Aristide, they bring him. And the first thing he does was remove the petition, the request for the reparations. Right. So that was one of the first acts. And so that tells me there's definitely a direct connection. And I think, you know, ever since then, you know, people have picked up on that. So for example, the New York Times had a whole story on reparations. But what's not included in that story is the fact that Haiti's under current occupation now. And people want to forget that there's an occupation going, that there's no sovereignty in the country. But I do think it's very much linked to the request for this payment back. That you have this coup d'etat. I mean, but Aristide was already, that was the second coup against Aristide. The CIA was behind a coup of Aristide in 1991, 9 months after he was elected by a landslide, after we had 30 years of a U.S.-supported dictatorship. And so they've been after him, but this particular time, I think this played a big role in having him removed.
Well, stay with us, Dr. Pierre. You have a lot of information. I'll be back right after this with you.
A country with 10 million people, which shares the island with the Dominican Republic. Haiti is a country which has never been forgiven by Western imperialists for its revolution in 1803, where slaves beat them all and declared its independence. It took France until 1825 to recognize Haiti's independence, and this came only after Paris sent 12 warships and threatened Haiti to repay France for its lost revenue and property, meaning the slaves and their labor. Up until that time, no country would trade with Haiti. The French demanded the astronomical amount of 150 million gold francs. It took Haiti until 1947 to pay this crippling debt. This prevented Haiti from having funds to invest in its own country. Because of financial pressure to pay France, Haiti got a loan from the United States. In 1914, the U.S. sent soldiers to collect what they called the debt, invaded Haiti, and went directly to Haiti's national bank and walked out with $500,000 in gold, packed in wooden boxes. The gold was in the vault of a Wall Street bank within days. The U.S. then occupied Haiti for 19 years and left in name in 1934. Since that time, there has been coups, assassinations, and interference by Western governments, as well as international organizations. In 2003, the president of Haiti at the time, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, demanded that France repay